Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to issue 58 of Hey Kids Comics. We're already on issue 58 somehow. Andrew Farmer here, as always, with my co-host, and probably... What was that?
I'm just amazed. It's already eight.
I know.
Past the 50th, which was a big milestone for us.
I know. That's the dulcet tones of the Jedi Cole Houston, of whom the podcasting network you're listening to is bequeathed from and given us room
to
play.
I'm actually working on changing it to dulcimer tones.
There are a lot of jokes.
Gossamer, maybe.
Gossamer. Gossamer's nice.
Gossamer tones, yeah.
That voice you hear over there.
Gossamer's a bit diaphanous for my taste.
That voice you hear over there, we have come to an accord, a truce, if you will. That is the voice of Matt Morrison. He is, or was, I should say, the...
He's a retired comic trivia god.
Right. He's the Kasparov of... He's the Deep Blue of comic trivia. We would write comic trivia specifically to stump him. That's what we would do. Met him... How long ago did I meet you? 4 years ago now?
4 or 5, yeah.
God, it has been a long... What in the... That has been a long time. The guy... He's a machine. He's a machine.
It's worth noting that I only retired from doing comic trivia at AllCon, where they run the yearly comic book trivia contest. All over conventions, I'll still go and compete at, and it's my dream to one day make Mark Waid cry, "Dear God, I thought I knew a bunch of useless crap."
Right. You want Grant Morrison to immolate himself. That's what you want to have happen. Tonight, I've got an admission to make. I haven't gotten much sleep. I'm not going to be much use to this show. I'll probably do my standard dick and fart jokes and occasionally try to say something witty. And
probably nap during the first act.
I might nap during the first act. I might.
So you brought me in to put you to sleep. Is that it?
No. I brought you in to keep me awake. I'm going to be nodding grandpa in this episode. What? So, Cole, would you please explain the Tinder precipice of which we stand tonight?
Certainly. This, I guess it does beg me to explain, because this was my idea for some reason. Possibly to challenge us.
Right.
And, of course, the title, as you have seen, if you've seen the header, or if you don't just go blindly clicking on this without checking to see what we're on about, is, of course, what? No pictures? And the purpose of this particular issue is to explore a genre, a comic-related genre, basically something involved in the realm of comics that's not often explored on shows like this. And that is when comics make the jump from being great big splash pages and lots of art and leg pouches and what have you, to being prose.
Yes.
We've taken, and I'm not talking about your little big books, Spider-Man zaps Mr. Zodiac. I'm talking about zero pictures.
Granted, the little big books.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Where does this start? Like, how does this come into being? This idea that you can take a comic book, and granted, comic books have ebbed and flowed through publication, more popular, less popular in different times. But how do you decide, hey, you know, this four color, 28 page, 60 year continuity comic book that I have would probably make a really good novelization. When does that start? What's the jumping on point for something like that?
Well, I've got a theory about that, actually, at least so far as the more recent run of graphicless novels. Let's go ahead and
okay.
But I think that the first run of them, at least the ones that I'm aware of, and I'm still trying to track these down to look at them someday, is I think the first run started coming about late 70s, early 80s, and they were Superman stories by Elliot S. Magan, who is one of the great, you know, Superman writers. He wrote a few Superman books that are believed by some today that even though they're not comics, they're some of the best Superman stories ever written. And I think a lot of that...
I think it's interesting you mentioned, though, that this is happening in the 70s, because this is also a period where literally everything under the sun had novels.
Right. I've got a... Downstairs, I've got a, you know, an old, I think it's a Del Rey paperback of the Happy Days. Yeah, it's so yeah, they're churning them out at this point.
Well, it's like most popular entertainment. I mean, the companies, they're in the business of making money, and if they think that they can make money by paying a hack writer to churn out a half a day's novel or whatever, get that done in 2 weeks, they're going to do it, because Happy Days was huge back then. I think in the case of the Superman books, it was because that was shortly after Warner Brothers had purchased DC Comics.
Okay.
And Warner Brothers, of course, also owns Warner Publishing, so they thought, hey, if we can get, you know, some actual books, you know, books with Superman to get people to buy those.
Right.
You know, absolutely. Well, another thing is that, like you said, they're in the business to make money, and other people are in the business to make money, and they see Marvel or DC making money off these characters, and they want a piece of that action. Years ago at a thrift store or somewhere, or a Half Price Books, I actually found a Justice League LP.
Nice.
And it was songs and little vignettes acted out by some of the hack actors they could find of stuff about the Justice League. There's a song about Metamorpho.
You love that song, though.
I love Metamorpho's song. It's the story of the Element Man.
I wonder if we can find that somewhere. Like,
I wish I had kept the thing. I think I eventually sold it off, but because I didn't have anything to play it on anymore. But one of the best things was the Justice League theme song, where they do the Justice League roll call. Superman here, Batman here. What? Batman sounds like some Bowery top. Yeah,
I'm here.
But, yeah, the thing about it is that record albums, children's books, novels, anything you could put out is just as viable as your coffee mugs and your action figures.
And what's funny to me is that a lot of people think this is some brand new thing that, you know, they've become shameless about this ever since, you know, the 80s with all the action figures that went along with the boom in, you know, children's cartoons. And they've been doing this for years. I mean, back in the 20s and 30s, the pulp days before the superheroes, mass marketing through multiple media was a big thing back then. I mean, that's why you had, I mean, Edgar Rice Burroughs did.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah.
Here we go.
It goes back that far. I mean, you know, he wrote the original Tarzan books, and then they did, you know, the Tarzan serials. They had the Tarzan comics. They had the Tarzan spin-off novels.
I also want to say that Tarzan cereal is what I really miss that. It's one of my favorite breakfast foods because it tasted like coconuts and monkeys.
We've had to put a sort of a moratorium on Edgar Rice Burroughs, because when you mention Edgar Rice Burroughs, Cole drifts off into a land that nobody can bring him back from for like
an hour.
I wind
up somewhere between Pellucidar and the untamed, uncharted, dark continent of Africa.
He has a literal gray stroke, and we have to bring him back from that.
A gray stroke.
That's what we're going to call it when you do that. But you're absolutely right.
I like that.
You're absolutely right that they've been doing this since the 20s and 30s with Buck Rogers and especially the Phantom and who were we talking about before, Cole?
The Shadow, yes.
Dick Tracy.
The Shadow started out as a radio show and then it became a comic book character after that.
Flash Gordon, you know,
Doc Savage, the Lone Ranger.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, this is not new. And what people fail to realize is at this point, I don't want to say it's looked down on or it is considered a hacky thing to do a novelization of a comic book, you know, to do an original story with the comic book characters in them. But even up through the, you know, the 80s and the early 90s, we old timers, and yes, I'm considering all of us in this group old timers when it comes to this, didn't have the internet to fall back on. We didn't have, and I will posit this, that I will stand more strongly with a novelization of The Incredible Hulk written by Peter David or something written, a Superman novelization based on the movie, than I would over some of this crap-ass slash fiction that I've How much? It's awful unedited crap. At least these things are put together, edited, run through the mill, and
you have to admit you did enjoy that Iron Man / Captain America novel I wrote and sent to you.
I did enjoy it. I did enjoy it. Scotch and Freedom.
In a perverse kind of way.
Scotch and Freedom was great.
I want to hear any more about this.
Your skin is as cold as the iceberg.
It was pretty much my great American bad novel. I think it's like Spider-Man says, everybody gets one. But the thing about this, what's interesting, though, is you go from, like, say, the period of the little big books where you had, like, an illustration every 25 pages because felt like they had to have some drawings in there, to your more just solid novels of the 70s and into the 80s and again in the 90s. There was an interesting shift because you go from the hack writer to actual comic writers writing these novels.
Yeah.
And that's actually what got me into comics, weirdly enough. I hate to, I'm honored to be included amongst the old guard, but the sad truth is that I didn't start reading comic books until just about 1998, just before turn of the century, and made up for lost time because, tell a family secret, my mom, when I was a kid, she had no trouble with me having the Superpowers action figures, watching Super Friends cartoons. I had the Underoos. My first, Halloween costume was Batman. My brother and I traded off being Batman and Robin every year. But my mom, because she was a librarian, she was dead set against having comic books in her house.
Okay.
So here was all the graphicless novels.
Right.
So my way of getting around that and sneaking it in was that, well, I did wind up encountering, somewhere along the way, I got the novelization of, as a teenager, I got the novelization of The Death of Superman by Roger Stern, and the novelization of Batman Nightfall by Dennis O'Neill, reading through it and then finding out after the fact that, well, yeah, these novelizations told you most of the story that happened in the comics, but they didn't tell you all of the story. Like, for instance, The Death of Superman novelization, everything with Hal Jordan and the Green Lanterns, that's cut out.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, so it still tells the same basic story about Coast City being destroyed and all of the other Supermen coming together to fight Cyborg Superman. They just edited out Hal Jordan's part in that because, Green Lantern being there was kind of a distraction away from Superman coming back from the dead to help save the day.
An interesting thing about these, I've always been curious because I knew there were novelizations of, say, Kingdom Come, of Nightfall,
right,
Death of Superman, any number of other big event comics. And I've always been curious, did they, in your opinion, have a kind of novelization approach or a proper prose approach? Did they bring more to the minutiae of the story than, say, just an illustrated story would have?
I think you're kind of comparing apples and oranges with that. I mean, the fact of the matter is that you tell a regular novel differently than you do a graphic novel. I mean, graphic novels, by their nature, are a collaborative art form between the artist and the writer, or, the artist who is also writing the story at the same time, in the case of the...
Or at least at their best, that's what's happening.
Right, right. At their best, a collaboration. Sometimes you get the infighting, but ideally, you have a collaboration between the two without them, fighting over this, that, and the other. Novelization, I remember Neil Gaiman once said that, writing is the most solitary art form that there is, and, there's some truth to that. The quality level, I think we'll all agree by the time this is over, is that the quality level in a lot of these, graphicless novelizations is all over the place. There are some of that have been very bad and some that have been very good. Now, you mentioned the Kingdom Come one, and that one was also written by L.E.S. Magan, who I mentioned earlier, doing a lot of the Superman novelizations.
Mm-hmm.
And it is one of the better ones. They cut a few little things here and there, but for the most part, it's all there. In fact, quickly jumping to another genre, I actually owned the audiobook of the Kingdom Come novelization.
Wow.
And it was hard to find. I stumbled across it once. I wish I'd kept it, but I didn't have a tape player anymore. They basically did it like a radio play almost, instead of it being just a straight novelization with one person reading it. They had different voices doing it, and they did special effects for it. Like when the Flash was talking, they had they sped the tape up because the whole thing that they mention in the novelization, and they kind of refer to it a little bit in the comic, is the Flash can't slow down. You know, he can slow down just enough to be seen, but he is, even at his best, when you hear him, he says, "Oh, okay, I gotta go there and saw this thing."
He also did.
They just sped the tape up, but the effect works for what it is. And
that explains the novelization. They also said something about the Flash doing Micro Machine Man commercials.
Right.
It was like somewhere between the Micro Machine guy and the Chipmunks. Just somewhere on that. It wasn't high pitched.
I hadn't thought about that. Hey, it's Dave Seville.
It was pretty good. The Flash. The voice acting was great. I don't remember any of the actors who were involved, but they there weren't any big names, I don't think. But I remember thinking, guy playing Oliver Queen, you know, ticked off, old as heck, you know, Oliver Queen. It sounded like George Carlin. It wasn't George Carlin, but it sounded like him. And ever since then, I miss, you know, I hate the fact that I'm a big George Carlin fan. I hate the fact that he's dead. But the one thing that I really regret is that after hearing that, I thought, yeah, George Carlin would be the perfect person to voice Oliver Queen if they ever did a Hard Traveling Heroes cartoon, just because he has that whole, you know, pissed off, I hate the world, you know.
Right. That's awesome.
I mean, I actually have been debating putting something on my website about just doing random quotes and saying, okay, can you guess which one is the Green Arrow quote and which one is the George Carlin quote?
That's a really good idea.
It's like, that's rather an ironic thing that my sidekick's name was Speedy, and yet he got hooked on speed.
Which one? Who said it first?
That's right.
No, but that's
an interesting thing, because it seems at first blush a little off topic, but it's exactly what we're talking about, and it's interesting that they took an entirely different approach to what would otherwise be just an audio book. They made it actually an audio play, which, like I said, now I want the damn thing. But I do half remember seeing that was done, and I didn't realize it wasn't just a plain old audiobook. But I was curious, though, you know, a lot of times if you read the novelization of a movie, for example, there's a lot of freedom to extrapolate on 5 seconds on screen with a lot of internal dialogue and stuff like that. Do they ever, from the ones you've read, adaptation-wise, where you can compare, do they ever get into that sort of thing, or is it just pretty much trying to get the story all crammed into however many pages
there's a little bit more internalization, especially, I haven't had a chance to go back and read every single issue of Batman Nightfall, but I do remember there is a bit more internalization. There is a lot, I remember there being a lot less of the thought balloons in the comics from that I did read. There is a lot more getting into the character's head, because with a novel, you can do that, and to a degree, you have to do that, whereas in an illustrated, you know, story, you can have a little bit of the thought balloons, but everything tends to get shown more through the action, rather than, here we have Batman having eternal soliloquy about how he is crippled and helpless.
Right.
Yeah, and instead, in the comic, you just have, like, Jean-Paul, what's his name, running off to be, Ezreal Batman.
He slaps Nightwing or Tim Drake or whoever it is at that point and straps on about 5 more pouches and right. Storms out.
From what I remember, in the novelization, Tim Drake was there. I don't think Dick Grayson showed up in the whole thing, oddly enough.
Would you?
Catwoman wasn't in it either. I know she had kind of a big part in it.
Yeah. But then again, you know, if you were rewriting it and you were able to say, would you want to be around for that? I don't know if I would, if I was Tim Drake.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, Dick Grayson. I might be like, you know what? I'm not out. I'm out. The ones that get me, and I've read a few of these, and I'll tell you who I think does it best, but the ones that get me are the ones that are, okay, we're going to take a comic book, and we're going to adapt it into a movie. Then we're going to take that movie adaptation and adapt it into a novel. Those are my favorites. Because you take for the most part, most of the movies are based on a story arc or a premise that has happened within those comic books. the Avengers first meeting, fight Loki for whatever reason. Okay. The origin of Captain America, X-Men, you know, all of those things. And then just, so you could take those ideas that came from a comic book or a series of comic books or continuity within a comic book. You extrapolate that and you say, okay, I'm going to make this work for the big screen. I'm going to take these panels in this comic book, figure out a way to cast it and script it, and then I'm going to put it on the big screen. You put it on the big screen, and then you go, okay, I'm going to take everything that we just did, and I'm going to boil it down to the roots and berries, and I'm just going to type it up. Like, what? Why? Why? Aside from money. Aside from making
merchandising, money. Merchandising is what I'm saying.
And the thing about it is that Marvel did, there were a lot of things that were based on Marvel. It seemed like early on there was a lot of DC stuff I was aware of. And as we were getting ready for this, I started remembering seeing half-price books where they cram all the collections because they don't want to bother trying to figure out where everybody is by author. I do remember seeing, raising an eyebrow, saying, oh, look, there's an X-Men novel or two. There's a Spider-Man novel or two. And kind of poking around, looking at things, I realized there were a lot of trilogies that were put together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My favorite was a Spider-Man trilogy that had the Lizard Sanction was one of the
titles. I have one of the books.
Octopus
from the
Agenda.
I think I have the Lizard Sanction somewhere around here, and I'm not being facetious. I'm not about to make a joke.
I've read all three of those. I actually struggled trying to remember those titles in my prep work for this one, looking that one up.
Sounds an awful lot like a porno.
Crazy part about Octopus Agenda is that they don't actually meet until the last 20 pages, and it's just like, okay, yeah, we got the fight scene over. There it is.
And we're done.
It just kind of depressed me, because there is this one, talking about the trilogies, there was a trilogy of Spider-Man books that all had to do with the Sinister Six. And you want to talk about how they got crazy with taking stuff from the comics. The whole concept sounded kind of outlandish because one of the subplots was that one of the new villains who was recruited for this might have been Peter Parker's twin sister, who he never knew about up until this point.
Wow.
And that sounds completely and totally crazy, but in the context of the story, it actually worked. Because it wound up tying into some of the stuff Stan Lee did back in the very first Spider-Man annual, where they reveal that Peter's parents, the reason why they died and left him an orphan, was that they were spies working for the federal government trying to expose Hydra and the Red Skull, and how, hey, they're still alive, they're still doing stuff.
Right.
And the whole concept was that,
They're actually worse parents than Darth Vader.
Shockingly, yes.
So let me ask this question. Has there been any adaptations, anything that's happened in the novelization of something that has come back round and ended up in the comic books? Anything that might not have been in there that somebody that we're aware of that somebody's picked up on? It seems like something that Grant Morrison would do, or a Bendis would do, that Grant Morrison picked up on something that somebody said during No Man's Land and then slid it into a Batman issue somewhere where you're just like, wait, where did that come from? And then in some convention interview at some point, you know, it was like, it was from this novelization of this, and that's why it makes sense, so get off my back and let me smoke my cigarettes and drink my scotch. Does anybody know of any that happened with?
I can't think of it. Truth be told, most of the novelizations I've seen, they'd rather ignore that they ever happened if it was just an original story.
Right.
One good example of that is, it was meant to be a trilogy, but apparently it was so low-selling or so awful that they just pretty much said, yeah, we're not going to bother with book three. And you can probably find these half-price books if you really must, but I'd advise against it. They did two Hellblazer, you know, John Constantine novels. One was called Warlord, one was called Subterranean, and I'm a pretty big Hellblazer fan. And I remember reading through it, and it was like reading some of the later Brian Azzarello stuff, where you're just going, no, wrong, it's continuity, or the Peter Milligan stuff before they canceled the book. It was like, no, this would never happen, violates the magic rules in this, no. Because, without getting too heavy into the details, one of the two books opens with a scene of John meeting up with his ex-girlfriend, Kit. Now, Kit was this girlfriend who got introduced in Garth Ennis' run on the book, and she basically was the big love of John's life, but because of everything that he was doing, she couldn't cope with it. She left him, and she showed up at the very end of the run. They had one last night together, and then she just walked off, disappeared, left him forever. And the whole, you know, gist of it was that John actually respected her enough not to try and make an issue about her ever get into her life again. And this one book opens with, yeah, John tracks her down to try and get back together with her, and it does not go well. And I'm pretty sure that half of that was the second book, now that I think about it. I'm pretty sure the reason they ended up book three was that at that point, half of the John Constantine fans just said, right, threw it against the wall, wrote an angry letter to Karen Berger, and they just said, yeah, we're not good. Of course, the hopes weren't high because the guy who wrote these two books also wrote the novelization of the Constantine movie.
Okay, I was wondering if that coincided in any way.
Well, actually, they did, because in the second book, the guy wound up trying to make the Constantine movie canon to the rest of the Hellblazer stuff.
Okay, yeah.
By virtue of suggesting that, well, there are all these parallel Earths, and all of these things happen, and on one of these Earths, you are an American with dark hair, and it's like,
No.
Oh, ouch. But it's interesting, though, because we're talking about, you know, the money aspect of things, and certainly those... We're trying to squeeze some money out of the whole Constantine film thing.
As humanly possible. Yeah.
If anybody cared about that enough to pick up the book. But there was an interesting thing, because at the time when the Vertigo imprint was launched, one of the hottest, or if not the hottest selling anything that pretty much carried the rest of the line was Sandman. You know, for moody, brooding goth people and sophisticates and others, it was quite the thing. I never tried to get into it myself, but I can see where people would. And I recalled seeing a book, and I, in my looking around, it apparently was released in hardcover and a year later in paperback, Sandman Book of Dreams, which was a short story collection.
I read that one. It was very good. It was your typical short story collection. The quality varied here and there, but you know, there wasn't anything that made me say, no.
Right.
And certainly that was another example. It's just a great example of how, you know, we've got a huge cash cow. Where else can we, you know, we're not going to have Sandman Saturday morning cartoon. So obviously our consumer base for Sandman are pretty literate crowd.
Right.
Otherwise, they wouldn't sit for the fact that most issues had more words than pictures.
So let's just make it all words and no pictures. Yeah. And I think that they did business at a very good clip with those. And I think that they took that and ran with it in a lot of respects, because at the time, which Sandman was popular, I was a young, brooding, cure-listening, black-wearing guy, and while I never read the novelizations of them, I did read the graphic novelizations of them, but I can't count the amount of friends that that read them, you know, that read it. I can still see the image, the completely marketed towards my demographic image of the actual book jacket. You know, it was the
all the twisted Dave McKeon covers and everything.
Right. So kudos to them for realizing that and running with it. So I got a question. Since I want to call back to the Constantine moment for a second. What continuity do these exist in? Has that ever been made clear? Has anybody ever said, outside of the usual, and even the ones that are adapted from movies? Because they've been pretty clear on both sides of the fence for the most part, and I'm not talking about your elf quests and your stuff like that, which do exist, and again, for a certain segment of the population, do a lot of money for the publishers. You know, on either side of the big fence, the Yojimbo fence, the two publishers have kind of established, all right, we're making these movies, the continuity exists, but this is how it exists. You know, it's either a different Earth or one of the parallel worlds or one of the part of the multiverse, and right. So it's within continuity. Have they ever said anything about these books that we know of, saying, okay, because it's a sticky wicket in a lot of ways.
I do recall that some of the Marvel books I read did have a note at the front saying, this story takes place immediately after, you know, this particular book. I just realized that probably all the Spider-Man books I've ever read aren't in continuity anymore because they had Peter and Mary Jane married.
Right. But what about when you take a movie that's already... Okay, so you take a movie and you launch it into Earth, you know... Earth 37 or Earth 616 subcategory B1239 if you're Marvel.
Marvel, yeah.
And then you say, okay, I'm going to take this movie which already exists on this weird parallel Earth that we've created and then make a novelization of it. So it's going to exist on this moon of this weird Earth that we've created. So that was always something I wondered is how do they justify that? I need to do some research into seeing if it's ever come full circle.
I don't think
it sums up for the most part, to be honest.
Yeah.
My personal suspicion is they
just never bother because there's so many publishers vying for these things.
I actually went on spiderfan.org, which is the best Spider-Man fan website that there is, and was trying to look up some of these old titles that I remembered that I couldn't remember the title or the author, but I remembered the story. There's just a huge, just even if you're looking under Spider-Man novels, they have them all grouped by publisher. And I had to go through the thing for about 10 minutes trying to find which publisher was responsible for it. And if you start adding up, you know, every single kids version, every single novelization that they wrote for kids, you know, just ignoring all the stuff for adults that we've been talking about, and all the movie tie-ins from there... you're going to have more than 52 universes just for all the variants on Batman alone.
Right.
Yeah, I think in that sense, literally even from novel to novel within a publisher, except in the series, you know, or like the Lizard Sanction being the middle book of a trilogy, there probably isn't a great editorial emphasis on continuity or being specific to a given universe, because as we talked about in our recent story arc, you can't count on continuity in the comics. You sure as hell can't count on it in the novels.
Right.
Yeah, pretty much the best you can hope for is that the writer is going to be true to their continuity and their stories and what they've written. And generally... depending on the writer, you can count on them being, you know, good to a certain point in regard to everything else. Like, for instance, the Sinister Six trilogy that I mentioned earlier had a lot of references to other things that were going on. Wolverine shows up at one point in the last book, and, you know, it's just portrayed as it being, it's your typical Wolverine-Spider-Man team. Wolverine just happens to show up because, hey, Wolverine just happens to show up sometimes.
Right, the subway stop was there, and...
Yeah. It was in town and smelled a fight. And another thing that's interesting is you have a kind of duality when it comes to these things because you've got your straight novels. Basically, you know, you've got a prose novel. It tells its story beginning, middle, end. Maybe it doesn't end if it's leaning toward a trilogy or some sort of, you know, George R. R. Martin epic, which thankfully we've not seen in the comic-related novels. And then you have the other genre, the other subgenre, and that is the anthology.
Okay, yeah.
And there were a lot of those. I actually have on my bookshelf, to my eternal shame, the Further Adventures of Superman, the Further Adventures of Batman, and the Further Adventures of Wonder Woman. It's not a shame to own them. It's a shame to own them and have never cracked the covers.
Right.
And there they are. Apparently there were later incarnations of both Batman and Superman Further Adventures, and essentially it's just a collection of short stories like in the anthology that are, they have a, you know, an editor who comes in and makes sure that all the stories are worth publishing and whatever else they do, but it's not, you're not going to pick this thing up and read a coherent story beginning to end.
No.
And in many cases I don't even think the universe is shared. It's just a bunch of different
It's a black man. It's a Batman black or white scenario. Yeah, I said it's a black man. That's how tired I am. It's a Batman black or white scenario. It is an anthology that exists outside of itself.
Yeah, and I think that also they're unlike, you do get some anthologies, I think, where they say, okay, here is a set world or a set of rules under which all of the stories, they may not be connected to each other, but they have to take place within this certain parameters.
Like the wild card. Books by
exactly, and that's what I'm trying to build toward, as a matter of fact. But I think in these, it was just sort of like they contacted some, you know, writers of various skill and said, write a Superman story, or we have this, you know, maybe they did an open call and the best ones got in. The wild card series is a very important thing to invoke because it is the superhero comic book genre purpose-built as prose. It's not an adaptation. We're coming at it from the other direction because the wild card series would get adapted, I believe, by Marvel under one of their imprints.
I think that happened just recently. I haven't yet to read it, but
it was many years ago because I picked up the first couple and was the problem with going from prose to graphic is you have a set idea in your own head of what everybody looks like or how you visualize certain characters, and inevitably the artists get it dead wrong. And a great example of this was a curious character that one of the writers in the wild card series created, and I'll probably get this dead wrong, but it was like the great powerful turtle, something like that. It was basically this guy who was a telekinetic, and he used like old derelict cars in the junkyard to build basically he could float these vehicles around with his mind and use them as a kind of a conveyance. So they, you know, the first one, they took an old VW and welded a bunch of metal plates all over it for protection. And, you know, over time it was almost like Iron Man. It was like Mark One, Mark Two. And
Who wrote that?
It was written by numerous authors, but it was edited by
George R. R. Martin.
Was it?
Yep.
Because I wanted to say that, but I wasn't going to commit.
I have in my grubby little paws the comic adaptation of Wild Cards.
You would do that to me
from Bantam and Spectra. Murphy, Epic Comics. Now, this is...
So that would have been Marvel's Epic imprint.
This is from the 90s. And yes, I have the run. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know how in the hell I have it. But I have it within my hands.
And that was just, you know, the thing about it is, in the comic, it was like, okay, whoever the artists were probably given a vague idea of some of the concepts.
Now, keep in mind, I've never read it.
Yeah, well, apparently the artists on that series had never read the books.
Okay.
Because if you see there's a scene where the guy that's the great powerful turtle or whatever he was called is passing by sort of Hall of Armor style, the various incarnations of his conveyance. Yeah. And essentially it looks like if you're watching the end of Speed Racer, as if the VW bug had been around forever, and then you're working your way to that hover rocket thing,
right,
that they drive by in. It was just a bunch of different like incarnations of VW bugs, and it's like, no, you don't get it. You didn't listen to what you were told. The VW bug was the scaffold upon which the turtle shell was built, but none of them were meant to look like VW bugs, only fancier. And I know this is a terrible nitpicking thing, but it bothers me, and this is good therapy, so shut up.
Seriously, I have no idea why I have these books or how I got them. I've never read them. I just know I was going through stuff the other day, and there they were. So here they are.
Well, kind of take things back around to where we started on this, just a fun story that I heard recently involving the Wild Card series and George R. R. Martin. Back in 1986, when the first anthology was put together, shortly after that, George R. R. Martin went approaching a bunch of different writers, you know, great fantasy writers, sci-fi writers, including Roger Zelani, John Williams, a couple of, you know, the legends today, and he wound up approaching Alan Moore and saying, you know, hey, I read your Superman work, it's really great, would you like to write a story for me? And Alan Moore, you know, said, well, thank you, but I'm in the middle of doing this thing called Watchmen that I'm busy with. Yeah, I'm in the middle of doing this, but I have a friend who, you know, he's helped me a little bit with some of the research on it. He's a journalist, you know, I think he's got some great ideas. I think he'd be, you know, great person to write for your anthology. Well, George R. R. Martin met with this guy, and he wound up tossing out this idea that he'd had for a hero whose power was that he lived in, you know, dream world, that he just, you know, inhabited the world of dreams and could manipulate reality through that. And George R. R. Martin said, well, it's an interesting idea, but, you know, you're just this journalist who's written a couple of books about famous people. You don't really have any fiction credit. I'm really not interested in, you know, taking the chance on you. So this writer wound up going to DC Comics and tossing the idea at them. Alan Moore's journalist friend was Neil Gaiman, and the idea he tossed at George R. R. Martin was the idea that eventually became the basis for Sandman.
Wow.
Yeah. Kicked himself for that one, huh?
And now they all sit around and drink, you know, 80-year-old scotch and laugh about it.
Yeah.
Especially now.
Yeah.
Especially George R. R. Martin now.
I think he's wiped away any tears he might have shed over this on those big fat checks from HBO.
Right, right. Big fat naked booby giant wolf checks that they're writing them every week over there. I'm remiss if I don't say, as again we always say about this time, we're winding down the show already somehow magically, that we were talking about the authors being true to the source material, and in the hopes that in some sort of that without a certain editorial mandate that they would stick with it.
And I think that's seen in a lot of the cases because much of the time they did get the authors to write the books, and if they didn't have a background in comic writing, they usually had a background in science fiction and fantasy where they were at least familiar with the elements and could, you know, make that sort of thing seem plausible in a purely print environment.
Exactly, like, and I think...
Right, you mentioned Peter David, he wrote the novelization of the Hulk movie, if I remember correctly. I think he did a few more.
Well, that's what I was just going to say, is look no further than if you want somebody who's going to be true to your editorial mandate, whichever company you work for, go no further than Peter David, whom, you know, is a wellspring of information, who has written the novelization of the Spider-Man movie, the novelization of the Hulk movie, not to mention standalone novels for the Hulk. I don't know if he did any standalone novels for Spider-Man, but he definitely did the adaptations for those.
Wrote a ton of original fiction for Star Wars, or not Star Trek, as well.
He's an insanely
prolific writer who also did tons of just regular proper comics.
And
TV scripts as well.
Oh, yes. And he's Oscar Wildean in his wit. He did a series of books called Sir Apropos of Nothing.
Yeah.
And they are absolutely brilliant and hilarious and funny and poignant and weird and smart. So kudos to Peter David for championing, you know, along with guys like Wolfman and Busick and guys like that, for championing the idea that a novelization, even of a movie, can be something worth reading, and it doesn't have to be just hack work, you know. So
yeah, because I think the very best ones, the ones that stood with me, were the ones written by the same writers who worked on the comics. Like, for instance, I mentioned earlier, the Death of Superman novelization written by Roger Stern, who wrote Superman Forever and Ever and Ever. The Nightfall novelization was written by Dennis O'Neill, who was the Batman editor.
Right.
Forever and Ever, the guy who created Ra's al Ghul, the League of Assassins, all those characters.
Oh, Denny. Oh, yep. Denny O'Neill.
Elliot S. Magan, who we mentioned before, great Superman writer. He did the novelization of Kingdom Come, among other great Superman books from the 70s and 80s. And one that surprised me, I actually found this one out when I was doing my prep work. The first graphicless novel I remember reading was the Spider-Man book called Carnage in New York.
Okay.
And it wasn't anything, you know, that great. I mean, it was decent. It was, you know, it was my first exposure to Carnage, and I most remember it because I tried selling it back at the used bookstore in the small town I was living in, and they refused to take it because they thought it was satanic, because it had that big picture of Carnage on the front going, well, I'm looking up the name of the author who wrote it, trying to find that book, and I realized that the author was David, I'm probably mispronouncing the last name horribly, but Micheline.
I think that's close to what I've heard, or about
right.
what I've heard.
Then. Well, at any rate, he was, you know, the writer on Iron Man forever and ever, wrote a lot of the Armor Wars.
Okay.
I think he did Demon in a Bottle, too, now that I think about it.
Wow.
I believe you may be right.
So, yeah, I think the great common thread is finding a writer who, it helps if they have a familiarity with the genre, but I don't think they necessarily have to be a comic book writer, per se, because Diane Duane, who wrote the Venom Factor, Lizard Sanction, Octopus Agenda that we mentioned earlier. I'm not sure if she ever, I can't swear she never did comics, but I mostly know her for her science fiction work.
Right.
And her work doing fantasy books for young adults. But I also know that she wrote a few episodes of the Batman animated series with Bruce Timm.
Very cool. So my fine, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Okay, I was going to say, but you can't take as a sign of quality all the time either, because one of the worst series I ever read was written by Christopher Priest before he changed his name to just Priest. And he's a good writer, but the series that he did, this three-part Green Lantern.
Oh, I've got it. I'm looking at it right now. The Sleepers series?
Yes, that's the
one.
Oh,
my God. That licks a donkey's ass. I was trying not to avoid at all costs.
I only read the first one, and that was enough. I just abandoned it at the end when Hal Jordan, and it's Spectre Hal Jordan, for those who remember that, when Hal Jordan was Spectre. Yeah, Spectre Hal Jordan shows up with Black Canary in a green space, you know, Volkswagen bus to save Kyle Rayner at the very end after, you know, he gets his butt handed to him by the bad guy. And it's like, Deus Ex Machina!
So, I guess I got one final question, then we're going to wrap up. So we'll keep the answers as brief as we can. And all the research that we've done for this, and knowing what we know and having the background that we have, does this show pique your interest in reading them? And if so, is there anyone that jumped out at you that made you think, I didn't know this was out there, I have to get my hands on it?
Well, I certainly, now am keen to get that audiobook adaptation.
Right.
Because that's just too freaking cool.
Right? I'm going to have to find that thing.
But also, I can't remember if I bought the novelization of Kingdom Come and just forgot. Because I think it was initially available in hardcover, and I may actually own a copy of that or something. But I think it would have been Kingdom Come. That if I do have it, I ought to be cracking the cover on it, and if not, I'd be kind of keen to look into that. Less passionately interested in actually bothering with these further adventures of books.
Right.
They're nice to have on your bookshelf as a collector. You know, having a nice library, even if you haven't read them all, is a very good, it makes you look worldly.
Right, right. Unless your library looks like mine.
Stuff.
Right, unless your library looks like mine and it has literally, what am I, 36 now? So 28 years of old D&D novelizations. And
but you got that Happy Days book.
I got it downstairs. It's front and center, baby. That is not even in the office. That
is
right out there.
Fonz meets Lazanga or whatever that was.
Oh, well, you guys keep talking. I'm going to grab it and tell you. I'll be right back. Now I want to know.
I think it was. If I'm not mistaken, I actually got that at a convention for you.
Was that you that did that?
I think I may have gifted you that.
I can't even remember anymore. Hold on.
Somebody gave me a number of books, and among them were Brady Bunch, Happy Days, and some other novelizations.
Oh, wow.
Novels, rather. And for a brief moment there, I was thinking about doing an article about the television shows. I think Laverne and Shirley, there were novels, and it was open season.
Well, one I did want to mention really quick as a good series that's worth tracking down is by Christopher Golden, who he has written some comics on his own. He writes a lot of novelizations. He wrote some very good stuff for Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But and I didn't know that he'd written this, but I read this one once, and I'm not a big X-Men fan at all, but I remember actually liking this novel series. It was called Mutant Empire. It was a trilogy, and weirdly enough, this actually came out before Grant Morrison's run on the book, but it has kind of the same idea. The whole plot is that Magneto takes over Manhattan and tries to declare it, you know, new mutants, you know, paradise. But the X-Men aren't just dealing with that. You have the one team who's trying to deal with that, you know, on Earth, and at the same time, there's some craziness with the Shi'ar Empire, so, you know, the blue team has to go into space to deal with that.
Okay.
It is, by the way, the Fonz and Lazanga, so I do believe it's the one that, I do believe it's the one that Cole bequeathed to me. Along with the Partridge Family, number two, The Haunted Hall, and a whole bevy of other
excellent
books.
Wow.
You have to love a Fonzie.
You just have to love a Fonzie. You could stop right there.
You have to love a Fonzie book where you meet some gypsy chick.
Right. The one book that I've seen in my research now that I really want to get my hands on is the adaptation of No Man's Land, the Batman, the Batman.
I think
my library, the one I work at, actually has a copy of that one still.
Because it's written. Greg Rucka wrote it. And if you've ever read any of Greg Rucka's comic books or his detective work, just in novelization form, the man is brilliant.
His run on Wonder Woman was amazing.
That's one that I need to get my hands on. That's the one I'm excited about, actually.
And also, when they relaunched Wolverine as a title for like the 8th time, not to be confused with the more recent 9th and 10th times,
right? At simultaneously, mind you.
Yes, but I believe if I'm not just way off base here, I believe he was the writer on that and did some really amazing stuff. I actually started reading Wolverine post Bone Claws.
Wow.
Because he was writing it.
The best Rucka work I've seen in many a year was his work on the new Punisher series that they did. What was it, 2 years ago now, maybe, or a year ago? When the first 5 issues, he scripted it, and he essentially produced it. And what I mean by that is the books barely had any dialogue in them. It was like Greg Rucka wrote it. It has 5 words in it. But the way that it was portrayed and the feelings and the emotions that was it was outstanding. It was outstanding. So that's one. Matt, do you have anything out there that you want to read now that you've been digging around in this?
Well, now I'm a little more determined to try and track down the Elliot S. Magan Superman stuff from the 70s. Haven't talked about this or remembered it. But one book I would recommend out to everybody out there, it's not an adaptation, but I just read it this past week, and it kind of amazed me just because it took 2 genres. I don't think it would have been mashed up this way. It's a book called X-Heroes, E-X-Heroes, by Peter Kleins. And it's an original universe, but the whole plot of it is that it's about a group of superheroes trying to cope in Los Angeles in the wake of the zombie apocalypse.
Okay.
Interesting.
And it is very interesting, just because it does have all the typical superhero stuff, and it flashes back to their lives before, you know, the disaster every 3 chapters or so. But then it cuts back to how they have this one, you know, they're trying to build this walled-in society, and they're protecting people still, and trying, only now their protection extends to them going out into the wasteland Fallout style and trying to get supplies, take them back.
Right.
And how they still have to cope with this gang that is, you know, fighting with them for the resources and trying to, you know, take over, because it's kind of like No Man's Land. It's a turf war over what's left of Los Angeles. And it's a good superhero story. It's a good survival story. There's a bit of comedy because at this point it's kind of a running gag that, you know, they're in Los Angeles and everybody there talks about what stars they know, what stars they've seen, you know, their best close encounter story. Mm-hmm. Well, they still have it, only now the biggest claim to fame is, I killed the zombie Alex Trebek.
That is a cool idea. I like that a lot.
Yeah, and everyone's like, well, I saw this one zombie. I'm pretty sure it was Lindsay Lohan. We were driving past her, so I couldn't stop to confirm.
That is cool. I like it. The one I would not suggest, I haven't read it, and I'm not going to read it, is the adaptation of the Steel movie starring Shaquille O'Neal.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Why don't we stay away from that? So
I don't think that's even worth mentioning. So we should probably cut that out in post production.
I'm leaving it in. Everybody's got to taste the pain. Everybody's got to taste the pain.
Tastes like copper and shame.
It does. It does not taste at all like Iron Man and Captain America slash fiction, which tastes like freedom and scotch. So let's go ahead and wrap her up. Let's get some final thoughts across the board. Cole, what do you have for final thoughts on this?
I want to say that, you know, going into this, I was aware of what we were going to talk about. I knew that these things were going on. I didn't realize how prevalent it was, how just amazingly diverse and rich the sheer volume of books that were out there. And I've certainly just kind of poking around on lists and stuff. I'm finding that there's some stuff that might be worth my while. Matt had brought up a couple of good ones. I think I may give it a try.
Okay. Okay. Matt, what do you got?
Well, it was a thrill doing this with you guys. I mean, we've encountered each other at the conventions before, you know, shaking fists at me as I work for attempts to stop me. You know.
Begrudging respect, my friend. Begrudging respect.
Hey, I'll take what I can get.
But do you have any suggest? I know you just suggested one to the people, but do you have
it's
any other ones?
To me, but, you know, I'm a librarian in my day job, so recommending books is, you know, second nature to me at this point.
Right.
Well, while you're out of the room, I did mention an X-Men trilogy, Mutant Empire by Christopher Golden. That
okay.
And that one's actually very good.
Cool.
The Sinister Six trilogy by Adam Troy Castro. That's a Spider-Man story. That's a pretty good one.
Okay.
And again, the novelizations of Kingdom Come, Death of Superman, and I haven't read the one that you mentioned, the Rucka one, but I'll probably track that one down because I remember seeing a copy of it at the library I work at, and we may still have it. We've kind of cleaned out the shelves recently, but
I think I'm going to track that one down. Absolutely.
Might be worth. Yeah, it should be worth. I mean, I'm not as big of a big Hispanic Greg Ruck as I think you guys are, and I didn't really like No Man's Land that much, which is why I hadn't read it before. But might be. I'm kind of, you know, talking about the differences. I am kind of curious to see what got left in, what got left out, and seeing if he ended with that whole stupid Huntress and Nightwing hooking up thing.
Yeah, so I don't even acknowledge that.
That's my personal axe to grind, just because, well, everything that was going on in the books right then is like, yeah, Dick and Babs are finally getting together, and then the stories that Greg Rucker is writing, no, he's shacking up with Huntress for no apparent reason, even though everywhere else he's still obsessed with Barbara Gordon.
Because he's a loner, Dottie. He's a rebel. That's why.
That's right.
All right, so
likes.
So let's plug some stuff. Matt, what you got? Plug a plug.
Okay, well, I'm actually writing for three different websites right now.
Wow.
I write for noflyingnotights.com. That's a website for parents, teachers, librarians, and other educators who are looking for reviews that will tell them what stuff is good for them to have in their classroom, what stuff is safe for their kids. And we cover adult material as well. The website was originally started to be mostly, you know, manga, hence the name No Flying, No Tights. But we cover superhero stuff as well, if you prefer the more traditional American comic type stuff. So it's got a good mix. It'll tell you about a lot of different things. And we also strive to give information, particularly focused on, you know, age-level appropriateness. So that's a good resource for the teachers and parents out there. I just recently started writing for a new magazine, Kaboom. 5 O's, no apologies is our slogan.
I love
it. Well, that helps you remember the spelling because there's a lot of kabooms out there.
Oh,
but it's www.kaboom.com.
Very nice.
And there's my personal website, mygeekyways.com, where you will find my personal writing, everything that isn't a review for something else, cosplay pictures, and me just randomly talking about all of the various geeky things I do.
Very cool. Very cool. Well,
and if you are in the Dallas area, you can see me performing with Amber Does Dallas. I'm the head riffer for the troupe. You can hear me shouting sarcastic things at Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Very cool. Thank you for coming on and saving our bacon tonight, man. That was...
Absolutely. And I do want to point out that Matt is very much like myself, a convention fixture
yes.
in the DFW area.
Yes.
I'm hung up someplace. That kind of fixture, yeah.
You're mounted to the wall. Thank you so much. Greatly appreciate you coming out. The show wouldn't have been at nearly as cogent, I guess, without you being here as it would have been. Cole and I would have fallen back on some Carney jokes or something.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been an honor and a privilege. I'd love to do this again sometime if you need another panelist.
Absolutely. And now that you said that, you are on speed dial, so
that's right.
You've entroubled yourself.
I'll have to get a red phone like Batman.
Right. You can find your way into the pit. We'll lower the basket down. Don't worry.
It's a lotion on its skin.
Or get to the hose again. So, of course, you can find us as usual on JediColeUniverse.com or JediCole.com.
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 I also do want to plug the 1975 Songs and Stories of the Justice League of America by Power Records, a division of Peter Pan Records.
Of course.
Which I found at least two sellers offering copies at $24.99 on eBay.
No. It's going to be yours. Let me do some searching for before you jump the gun on that. let me look around a little bit before you pull the trigger.
I had forgotten, though, that the back cover of this album is a gigantic image of Wonder Woman surfing on her invisible jet. So she's like outside with one foot on the nose cone and one foot on the fuselage.
That's awesome.
And she's about to use her lasso of truth to capture a missile that's being fired off some coastal test site or something.
Now I wonder if they've got the old LP that Stan Lee recorded back in the 60s with the Marvel marching song.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to be doing some research tonight.
You hadn't heard about that?
I'm going to be doing some research tonight. Marvel marching song, huh?
Yeah, I've only heard about it. I wonder if it's on YouTube, but apparently Marvel released an LP back in the 60s. You have to hear Stan and Jack and a bunch of the other bullpen people. And reportedly, you know, Jack Kirby sounds like James Cagney. Not surprising, but...
Right. Or was he affecting James Cagney is the question.
Gee, Stanley, could you mail all my money? Wait, that was more Edward Robinson than Cagney.
Yeah, it was...
I'm tired, too.
All right. Jedi Cole Universe...
Apparently there was a 1967 Mary Marvel Marching Society kit.
That's the one.
That has Scream Along with Marvel.
Oh, my God.
Album, apparently. Who says this isn't the Marvel Age of Riotous Recordings, it says. Yeah, somebody has apparently sent originally to Charles DeFistro, Bernardsville, New Jersey, way back in 67. And now, for a mere $200 plus shipping, it could be yours.
Wow, $200. All right. Next week, we have the long-awaited, and I'm going to say this now, and it's not going to make any difference because of when we're going to release this. I wish I could get it out more live than what we have it right now. But the long-awaited Chili Willingham episode, I believe, is actually supposed to come out next week. We're supposed to record
this
next
time.
Week.
We are actually going to make it happen. We have promised this
for six months.
Yes, indeed. We now have our guest lined up.
All right. So we're going to do episode issue 59, the Bill Chili Willingham story. or how I learned to love the podcast or whatever we're going to call it. I don't even know at this point.
How Bill Willingham finally finished something he started.
Or we finished it for him 6 months later.
That's right. Well, I think it's in keeping with Willingham's career in comics that Hey Kids Comics couldn't quite finish what we started for so very long.
So go out and check out Matt's websites, his various writings, JediCole.com, all kinds of good stuff coming out of there from What You Think to You Are Here to this thing that we do. All of that good stuff's coming out.
And you can also check out my companion site if you're like Matt and myself and you go to a lot of conventions in Texas.
Right.
at the Convention Awareness Project Texas, which is conventionawarenesstx.blogspot.org.
Cap Texas.
Cap Texas. Yeah, Cap Texas.
Cap Texas.
For Stu. Just found out today from Chris Kidd, the Uber producer down south of the Texas Comic Con and the recently added multiple times the year Texas Collectibles Expo, has become an even greater madman because he now has a horror convention coming up and a fistful of regional toy shows coming up, including a a Dallas show coming up in 2014. Wow. He'll have shows in Dallas, Corpus Christi, San Antonio, and Austin, and a couple of other cities that I can't recall at the moment. But there'll be more information on Texas.
What was that, Matt?
I said El Paso, maybe.
Probably.
Might have been El Paso.
Yeah. Hey, you know what, suckers? Eat it. Because in 2 weeks, I'm going to the Cincinnati Comic Convention, where no one knows me, and I'm more famous in Texas than I am in my own backyard, so everybody can bite me. I'm going to go hand out buttons and Jedi Cole trading cards. So you can put that in your website and smoke it, suckas. All right, just sign off. Bye.
I'll get the DFW G.I. Joe in action figure show and grapevine.
Well, yeah, you will. You and Eddie Funky Cole Medina.
Yeah, the great Bobby Blakey apparently is going to be not in Texas that weekend. So.
Of all the weekends not to be in Texas.
Yeah, exactly.
The venerable Bobby Blakey. He is the Harold T. Stone of comic book art. Yeah, there you go. Night Court reference. Who wants some?
I got it.
Thank you. That's why you guess all my trivia. Because we function on the same wavelength, and you know everything, so there's also that part.
Just about Night Court. I've been lobbying for them to get Season 9 on a DVD, finally, for years.
I need to buy them on... Do they have them on Blu-ray?
They barely have them on DVD.
Okay, the winning city was, in fact, Laredo.
Laredo.
Houston, Laredo, Austin, Dallas, San Antonio, and, of course, in October... They're in San Antonio, Nightmare Con. I'm just going to give Chris a plug here. Go to Comic Con America.
Okay.
C-O-M-I-C-O-N-A-M-A-M-E-R-A. Anyway, just go to ComicConAmerica.com. You can read all about it there. Lots of big shows coming up in 2014, including Overland Park, Missouri.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah, for mentioning conventions, I should probably mention the one I'm helping plan now. Well, I'm actually working with the ACON organization, you know, the biggest anime convention in Dallas, probably North America.
I believe it is not only the biggest, but possibly the oldest.
Right.
Might be the oldest. Yeah, it's definitely the oldest. It's one of the biggest, certainly. I'm not sure who keeps track measuring that, but it's, you know, freaking huge. Well, in my capacity as the coolest teen librarian ever, I'm working with them to arrange a second micro-ACON at the Burleson Public Library in Burleson, Texas, just south of Fort Worth. That's going to be October 19th on a Saturday. So, you know, if you are in the DFW area and would like to come to a smaller scale convention, website is up at burlesontx.com. You can also go to ACON and find the information there. See who all is going to be doing the panels and whatnot. We're going to have a costume contest, free play games, video card and board all day. And you get to come and, you know, help terrorize the normal people at the library.
Nice. Good.
And now that I know this,
it will be
on the Convention Awareness Project Texas October listings.
Ain't I
because you
like
can't
that.
Go if you don't know.
So, with the exception of the Steel... novelization. I'm going to end this like I always do. Buy, collect, and enjoy comic books. Buy, collect, and enjoy novelizations of comic books. Hit your half-price books. They've got thousands of them just waiting for you to take off their hands. So
and public libraries.
And public, thank you. And public libraries. We need to talk about that more on this show anyway, and which we will do. You have my word, bastion of honor and hope for all that is the public library. I'm letting that stand. So until next week, when Willie McPilly Chillingham gets his due, I'm Andrew Farmer.
I'm Cole Houston.
And I'm, for the first time, probably not the last, Matt Morrison.
Absolutely not the last.
Certainly not the last. Good night, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.